Welcome to day two of Cowen's TMT conference. My name's Colby Synesael, and I am the telecom services analyst here at the firm. For the lunchtime keynote, we have Krish Prabhu, who's the president of AT&T Labs and the CTO of AT&T. The structure of this is going to be 40 minutes of fireside chat. I prepared a bunch of questions, which I'm going to go through, and that should get us right to the full 40 minutes. First off, Krish, thank you for being here. I know before we start, you have some comments you have to make regarding the safe harbor.
Yes. Thank you, Colby, for inviting me, and great to be here. Let me get through the safe harbor statement first. Today's comments may contain forward-looking statements. They are subject to risks. Results may differ materially. Details can be found in our SEC filings and on AT&T's website. We also are in the quiet period for the FCC 600 MHz incentive auction, so we will not be able to discuss that today. Regarding FirstNet, we don't comment on any potential government bids. That's it.
All right. That was fun. We don't always get an opportunity to talk to a CTO. Can you start by telling us what your responsibilities at AT&T are and what they entail, including what you do with AT&T Labs?
Yeah. Thank you, Colby. AT&T Labs has approximately 5,000 engineers, scientists, some of them on temporary assignment. Primary charter is to architect the network, lead the network evolution, and essentially handle all the technology choices. I also am responsible for the supply chain organization because architecture has such a big impact on the supplier ecosystem, and also responsible for the intellectual patents, IP portfolio. The interesting things we are up to today, I'd say SDN NFV, an effort we started 3 years ago, really into the thick of it right now. We finished our LTE deployment, 300 million plus POPs last year or year before that, last year, I'd say. Right now we're looking at what does LTE Advanced mean to us, and how do we get the full power of LTE to our customers. We're also looking, preparing for next generation wireless, the transition from 4G to 5G. A big part of our new architecture is to have it inherently big data friendly, so we have a whole new big data framework that we use in the operations of the network, and that has its tentacles into everything we do. Lastly, looking at new usages for the network, such as the Internet of Things, as well as autonomous self-driving cars, and anything else that could be looking for network connectivity. Lots of exciting things going on.
Great. Hopefully we'll get to most of that. I wanted to start off by talking about SDN and NFV. You guys have said that your network is 6% virtualized as of year-end 2015. You guys have said that your goal is 30% by year-end 2016 and 75% by 2020. I guess just to start off, how are you guys defining percent virtualized?
Yeah. A good proxy for percent virtualized is to see how many network functions are actually virtualized. Let me first explain what virtualized means. Basically today or yesterday, most of the network functions that we deployed were procured as appliances or boxes from our vendors, and we would interconnect them in the network to realize a service. Going forward, we are largely buying software or what's called a virtualized network function, and wherever possible, the software runs on cloud infrastructure. We separate the software and hardware. Our network typically has about 250 distinct network functions. When we say 5% or 6% of the network has been virtualized, we are essentially saying that any new network function that's deployed in the network, in that cluster of virtualized network functions, is deployed as a software element running on cloud infrastructure as opposed to buying off-the-shelf hardware.
Okay. I'm obviously a services analyst, not the equipment analyst, so some of these things are lost on me. What's the difference between SDN and NFV?
Okay. SDN is software-defined networking. Basically it means anything and everything you need to do when you set up a network, operate it, tear it down, evolve it, grow it, is done by software. In order to do that, you really have to break down the network, disaggregate it into elements that can be controlled by software. We don't quite have that in today's network because when we buy large routers or optical gear, certainly there's a lot of software in there, but it's not visible to the operator. It just looks like a black box and you have limited control. In an SDN world, you want control down to the fundamental modular element of the component. And in order to do that, you first have to virtualize it, separate the software and decompose it into controllable elements. And then, of course, you operate the SDN control on top of it. So SDN and NFV, network function virtualization, kind of go hand in hand.
Okay. And as an investment community who is obviously the audience today, how should we think about the benefits of SDN and NFV? I would break it into, is it an OPEX savings? Is it a CAPEX savings? Is it a revenue generating opportunity? Just kind of walk us through how you think of with the benefits that come with doing this.
Okay, so I'll start with what got us here in the first place. 3-4 years ago when we were looking at the traffic growth in our network, especially in the early days of LTE launch, and since then it's only gotten worse, we were seeing year on year 45% growth in traffic in the core of the network. And AT&T, as you know, very early on as part of the One AT&T program, came up with a single core where all the traffic goes through our backbone. So today we have more than 100 petabytes of traffic, and we realized that there was no way we could handle the growth in traffic when CapEx was essentially flat. So the first advantage of SDN is to be able to handle 4 to 8 times the traffic with the same amount of CapEx. It gives us a high degree of modularity in where we deploy the capital. We don't strand any capital out there planning for traffic that may or may not come in the future. We have a fluid way of growing the network as the traffic grows. So those are all advantages of SDN. On the OPEX side, because everything is controlled by software, much like what the web guys do, lots of automated procedures, a lot of the manual operations of the network is now replaced by automatic scripts and automated procedures that would cut the OPEX costs literally by 40-50%. And then we've managed to introduce a class of enterprise services, loosely called Network on Demand, but also NetBond, a very popular service that allows you to VPN directly into a cloud from any managed site. And all of these services are possible with SDN. Without SDN, this would not be possible.
So it's interesting. So from a CapEx perspective, you guys spend roughly $22 billion per year. You mentioned that you're expecting the network to continue to grow. I think you said potentially to the magnitude of 10 times in the next 5 years is something you and I had discussed before. The key here is that if you're going to continue to have to support such demand, it's not that you're going to see absolute CapEx come down as much as it is how can you do more with less, or with the same, I should say. So taking the $20 and $22 billion and keeping that flat but effectively supporting more traffic.
That is an accurate assessment. When we look at handling more traffic, now is it going to be 10x? Is it going to be 8x? We just take the 40% growth, and if you play it out over 5 years, it turns out to be 10x today's traffic. But our design goal is to be able to handle that growth in traffic with no degradation in service for the same amount of capital that we currently spend.
And then on the OPEX side, I certainly appreciate you're not the finance guy, but based on your argument or point that you're going to see 40-50% savings, one should assume that over a period of time as this gets rolled out, and this is going to take some time, that we should see some improvement in the margins in the business as a result of this as well. Everything else, assuming, remains constant.
Yeah, so the OPEX savings will fully materialize when all the operating procedures are automated, and you know in a big network it's quite complex and we'll be operating in a physical and a virtual world simultaneously for many years to come. So the physical world will still be using current procedures or manual procedures. But yes, when we do get to a highly virtualized world, we talked about 2020 and 75% of the network being virtualized, yes, the operating benefits will start materializing at that point, and you ought to see it in the margins of the business.
I want to talk about the revenue opportunities in a moment, but before I go there, I want to talk about Domain 2.0, which is effectively how you guys described it, getting your vendors in line with what you're doing around SDN, and you guys did that back in September of 2013. How has been the vendor response, and talk about the vendor community that you're working with now around this?
Well, the vendors see it the same way as we do now. I think initially there was some reluctance, some skepticism about what can be done in this new architecture. Also, part of the challenge for the vendors was it certainly upset their business model because instead of buying boxes, we were now going to buy just software, and we would buy it in small chunks rather than big chunks. And we've also been very vocal about having open source play a key role in the ecosystem. So I think we're all learning. I think it's best to say we're all learning how the new ecosystem evolves and how we settle into business models that we are comfortable with. Part of it is every one of us has to transform as a company. But the real problem we are solving is how can we handle the growth in traffic at the same CapEx? And without this architecture, it would be impossible to do that. And I think everyone accepts that now.
If what you're asking from the vendor community now is more software-oriented opposed to hardware-oriented, one would argue that that enables a lot more competition to kind of come in to try to provide these services for AT&T or for anyone else moving in this direction. What advantages do your legacy or those historical equipment vendors have in being able to provide these more software-oriented services for you?
Yeah, the historical providers, suppliers know our network best. They know how we use their products. So from a functionality standpoint or usage standpoint, they certainly have more information than a new vendor coming in. But if they decide to stick to their existing business and they don't move fast, then you run the risk of losing the business to a new vendor because the new vendor would be motivated, has lower entry barriers to get us the software we are looking for. And we've seen that. So we call them disruptors. And we have several disruptors that have shown up in our network. And over 12, 18 months, they've caught up with some of the network-specific knowledge. So today they provide us network functions that actually are pretty good. We can run our network on their network functions. And traditional vendors have seen this, and they've also stepped up.
Last question on SDN before I pivot topics. But you talked about revenue opportunity. You already have some products in the market like Network On Demand and Neson. Can you talk about what those are and what the traction's been for things like that, and maybe as a precursor of other aspects that SDN enables?
So Network On Demand is really an enterprise product that allows the enterprise CIO to schedule on their portal additional network capability or functionality such as firewalls, load balancers, WAN accelerators, security appliances, because these are not really appliances but software that performs the function of a security appliance like intrusion detection, for example. It allows them to schedule this literally on demand. They can have this software run on a universal CPE on-premise, or they can have it run at the edge of our network, or they can even have it run in their cloud or a third-party cloud. This is the ability of SDN and virtualization to just use the network for what it's intended to do, which is just give you connectivity, but to have the flexibility to schedule this on top of that. And we see great take rate. We are now in 170 markets with Network On Demand. And this is just the beginning because you can bring on a lot of capability on top of whatever you have today. We also have a product called NetBond. It allows you to set up a VPN between your premise and a cluster of virtual machines or even a unique virtual machine inside a cloud. So it really gives you end-to-end secure connectivity between processes you run on-premise to whatever it is you're using in a cloud. And this also has had great interest in the market. And these products would probably not be possible if you didn't have this SDN infrastructure.
I wanted to talk now about wireless. So a lot of talk about 5G, one of the bigger competitors you have in the wireless space, I think creating a lot of buzz around 5G right now as well. How do you define 5G today?
Yeah, so there's two ways of looking at 5G. From the customer's eyes, I think clearly enhanced mobile, much better throughput on your mobile device, certainly massive IoT. Today, what we do in IoT, we treat it like the standard smartphone mobile connection, a bearer set up and taken down whenever it's not needed. So it's a connection-oriented IoT, but when you handle billions of devices instead of millions of devices, it's going to need connectionless service, so 5G brings you that. Then also the vision of 5G is to be able to do on a wireless network anything you can do on a fixed network, which means essentially not only have a lot of bandwidth and throughput, but also have low latency and the ability to do that very quickly. So 5G introduces that. So these three dimensions change the scope of wireless services when you go from 4G to 5G. But because you will now be using the wireless network for different applications that put different kinds of stress on the network, an important concept in 5G is also network slicing. You can create a slice of the network for the duration of the service that meets the demands of the service, i.e., IoT needs to transfer massive amounts of data for 10 seconds and then be quiet for the rest of the day. So the network slice is created for 10 seconds that allows you to do that. So network slicing is also a very important concept. And then 5G, from a technology standpoint, is going to introduce new spectrum in the millimeter wave of the spectrum, and that would be a whole new dimension for the wireless industry, who is so used to working below 6 gigahertz. Now we're talking about spectrum in 28, 39, and 60 gigahertz.
So a lot to cover there, but I think one of the interesting things you said as it relates to IoT is when I talk to investors and we talk about what today is referred to as machine-to-machine, it operates on 2G networks and in some cases 3G, but it doesn't require a lot of bandwidth. So people would argue, well, why do you need a 5G network to support IoT? Doesn't the networks that are already in place support that? But what's really interesting is it's not about the amount of bandwidth which they require, but the amount of devices. So if we're going from 20 million IoT or M2M devices to 20 billion, how does the network actually interact with all those devices at any one time? That's something that not necessarily is supported today.
Yeah, and the fact that it's connection-less service as opposed to connection-oriented service. Well, in connection-less service, think of it as a postal system. You drop a mail in the mailbox and the mail gets delivered. That's connection-less. Connection-oriented service is typically what we do with our cell phones today. You either call a number or text a message to another address, a connection set up, and then the message is transmitted. The big thing in IoT is the ability to do connection-less service for billions of devices at the same time.
So in February, you guys unveiled a 5G roadmap, and you said you're collaborating with Ericsson and Intel. Can you give us a little bit of color in terms of what you're doing with them and more broadly what you're doing to trial 5G today?
Yes, so this is a 5G millimeter wave trial. So we are going to start with 15 gigahertz in the summer here in a few months and then go to 28 gigahertz at the end of the year. It will be largely a fixed wireless service with some limited mobility. The goal is to understand propagation impairments and to understand how good the service is, see what kind of throughputs we get in real-life environments outside the laboratory. We've already seen 3 gigabits plus at 28 gigahertz. I think we'll also be looking at other vendors, but we announced the two vendors you mentioned.
It seems like when we think about 5G, fixed wireless is becoming more the focal point, at least in the near term. It seems like both you and Verizon are looking at various ways in which how you're going to deploy that. Is it possible that we could see you guys deploying something that you'll refer to as 5G, using fixed wireless, using potentially microwave, before the actual standards for 5G are actually put in place? So phase one of the 3GPP standards are expected to come out in September of 2018. Could we see you in the market before that with some type of commercial product?
Yeah, so we have a slightly different position than the competitor you mentioned because we are an integrated carrier, so as part of our DirecTV build, we also committed to a fiber rollout, which is pretty aggressive. We are doing fixed wireless in rural using standard LTE. So we have a good understanding of fixed wireless and understanding of what kind of customer prem equipment you need for fixed wireless. We will certainly be taking that and understanding what millimeter wave pre-standard fixed wireless allows you to do. So from a technology standpoint, we'll definitely be ready. The real question for us is, does the economics and the demand in the marketplace for that kind of service, because with 5G millimeter wave, you will have gigabit type throughput, and if the economics are right, even with pre-standard equipment, we will certainly consider rolling it out.
Yeah, there's been talk about fixed wireless for a long time. There's companies 15 years ago that were providing that to some degree, but there's always been concerns around the quality of the service. How far does the distance can that signal actually carry? If it's raining, is that it can actually provide some form of interference? What's changed to make this more formidable as a solution today than maybe it was, for example, 15 years ago, or even just 5 years ago?
Yeah, so the physics certainly hasn't changed. We know that. What's changed is some of the technology. So we've got a lot of antenna, smart antennas. We've got FD MIMO, which is massive FD MIMO. All of that works very well at these higher frequencies because the wavelengths are so small. You can pack a lot of antenna elements. Progress in beamforming technologies, progress in beam steering. So there's a common belief that when you bring the full power of the technology, some of the early impairments that we saw in field propagation could be overcome with smarter receivers that can reconstruct the signal that's been degraded in propagation. Time will tell if the technology is really there, but that's really what we're talking about.
And just about speaking more broadly about wireless, the phase two of the 3GPP standards talks about massive IoT and low latency, and it seems like that's going to be approved in 2019, maybe even 2020. So it does seem like mobile 5G is still many years away. So is it fair to assume that over the next few years, when we think of wireless and network improvement and evolving, it's really about a fixed wireless potential opportunity, which we may or may not market or at least brand as 5G, and then also really just continue to invest in the 4G LTE networks, which are already out there today. Is that a fair depiction?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. The millimeter wave, 28 gigahertz in particular, the spectrum that certain operators have is certified by the FCC only for fixed today. So until the FCC comes out with rules for mobile, we can't even use that for mobile. But I think you're right. Most of what we'll see over the next 2-3 years is fixed applications with millimeter wave.
And as it relates to the millimeter, the 28 to 38 to 39 gigahertz spectrum, to my knowledge, you guys don't actually own any of that today. Are there numerous sources to which you'd be able to go after to get that, assuming you guys decide that that is a legitimate spectrum band which you'd want to be utilizing?
I think the answer is yes.
And then I wanted to shift over and talk about small cells. So small cells, obviously, another very topical area as it relates to your business and in the wireless industry broadly. Where do you see the use of small cells in the network? What are you doing with small cells today?
Small cells are a good solution where you have coverage gaps or you have capacity hotspots. And in both those cases, it makes a lot of sense to use small cells, and that's what the LTE small cell usage has been. We have focused on getting a pretty good density of macro towers. We have pretty much a nationwide coverage of macro towers, and we will continue to look at small cells as options for the two cases I mentioned. But when you try to put millimeter wave spectrum or you try to put unlicensed spectrum has power limitations, so you have to put it on a small cell. Can go with a macro because that's too far from the end user. And millimeter wave, as we talked about, the propagation gets really bad once you go several hundred meters. So it's more timely today because people are talking about using unlicensed spectrum and carrier aggregating it with licensed spectrum to get more bandwidth. And they're also talking about using millimeter waves, again, because it has very high bandwidth. So I think as we go to enhanced mobile with more bandwidth to the device, the small cells really being a key element of the new architecture. In terms of how aggressive are we going to be, we are looking at added pretty aggressively. It depends on which markets and where we think the small cell makes sense.
When you think of the number of macro cell sites you have today versus the number of small cells that you have today, compare that to where you are today to where you think you'll be in, let's just call it 5 years.
Yeah. So we're probably at 90% of our macro site, 90% of where we'll be at the max 5 years out, let's say. We are probably less than 5%-10% of the small cell sites where we will be 5 years out.
So a lot more small cells.
A lot more small cells than macro.
Okay. And then just wanted to shift over to IoT. I'm just trying to get through a bunch of topics here. But Verizon has actually been, I think, pretty open about what their IoT strategy is. They've actually gone and marketed it as ThingSpace. They've talked about four or five different IoT use cases, small cities, home fleet management, et cetera. We've certainly heard AT&T talk about the connected car, but beyond that, and I'm happy to talk more about the connected car, but beyond that, what is IoT to you guys today? How big of a focus is it for you, not just at AT&T, but also what you're doing with AT&T Labs?
Yeah. So we all look at IoT in the context of the same verticals that you talked about: smart cities, smart grid, certainly asset management, autonomous cars, et cetera. I think the real challenge in IoT is it's not so much a networking problem. It's more of a big data play. You gather tons and tons of data, and you've got to do streaming analytics, and you've got to get the feedback loop to make your business decisions, because IoT really is a productivity investment for the enterprise, and that's where the investments are going to happen. So our solution clearly is an integrated solution that looks at not just the connectivity over the network, mobile or fixed, but also looks at how to get the big data in the right place and how to do the analysis on the big data as and when you need it.
And that's really interesting, which is IoT is effectively an enabler of big data. And then the question becomes, where does AT&T really want to play in that stack? Do you want to move from just being a connectivity device to actually providing something within the application layer, if you will, in terms of collecting that big data and perhaps even analyzing it on behalf of your customers? Where are you today? What do you think the thoughts around that, to the extent you could share them?
Yeah. We have an end-to-end platform, covers the whole stack. Of course, sticking to our knitting is more starting with connectivity, and the connected car example started out with facilitating connectivity in connected car. But we also partner with other big data players. You've seen our announcements with IBM and General Electric and others. I think time will tell how different players in the ecosystem establish their positions. It is a big cloud play for some of the big data players. For us, it's too early to say that we found our niche and this is where we'll invest. So right now, we are playing in several layers of the stack.
And just to provide a little bit more specificity, is there a difference between how we think about the industrial IoT opportunity versus how we think of the consumer IoT opportunity? Is it a big difference for you guys in terms of how you think about it?
Not really in terms of the reference architecture for IoT. The devil's going to be in the details. Consumers have different applications, especially related to personal wearables and things of that sort. Industrials really go by verticals. If you talk to a smart grid company, it's very different than what you talk to an asset management company. But I think the underlying framework is very similar.
Okay. Wanted to shift over and talk about your build-out strategy related to some of your wireline commitments that you made. So can you provide an update on your DirecTV commitment that you made with the FCC, where you've committed to delivering broadband to 12.5 million locations?
Yeah. So we're on track to do that. We are primarily using fiber to the prem. The momentum in our rollout is pretty good. We feel in the same time period we should be more like 14 million, even though our commitment was 12.5 million. There are some restrictions. These are all documented in the FCC commitments. But I think it's fair to say that the program's on track, and we feel very confident about the maturity of the technology and the economics.
And you guys have talked about, or not even talked about, but the requirement is over a 4-year period, so I think that takes you into, from when the deal closed, so that would take you into 2020. Excuse me. The other thing I wanted to bring up, though, is that it seems like building fiber to the prem is actually back in vogue. It seems like, obviously, Verizon had done that with Fios for some time, and they had slowed that down. You guys were doing more fiber to the prem, now you're doing more fiber to the node, now you're doing more fiber to the prem. What's changed? Why all of a sudden this focus on putting fiber all the way into the home again?
Well, a couple of things. The technology is certainly more mature. Verizon started back 2005, 2006. In fact, the early offerings was BPON, wasn't even GPON. We look at aerial options, not necessarily buried options. That's a new element now in terms of how quickly you can roll out fiber. The problem with taking fiber to the node is invariably you run into the limitations of copper, so you convince yourself you've got to push fiber deeper, which isn't unlike what the cable guys have also realized. They also end up pushing their fiber deeper and deeper as they go to higher speeds. So I think eventually this architecture that takes us all the way to the home future proofs the network for us. And some of the upgrade paths for that equipment going to multiple lambdas gets us to speeds of 80 gigs on the fiber, which is more than adequate in the foreseeable future.
And, you know, as part of connecting more device, more homes or locations, you guys also do have a fixed wireless solution, which you mentioned already earlier on. That's not what we're talking about when we think about 5G and using millimeter spectrum. It's actually using LTE, and it's part of your CAF II commitment. Can you talk about what's required there and where you are in that build-out?
Yeah, so CAF II is Connect America Fund. We get some FCC funds to build out rural networks. We use standard LTE equipment. The commitment is to provide 10 meg downstream, 1 meg upstream service. It's primarily a network engineering play. You engineer a network in a manner so that you guarantee this level of service. Our build-out there, again, has requirements on how many of these will be built out, and because we take FCC funds, this is indeed a strict commitment. The money can only be used for that. Technology is proven LTE technology, and we use spectrum, and in parts of the country where we don't really compete with mobile services, mainly because we have plenty of spectrum there. We also have mobile offerings, but the population density is such that we cannot use the same spectrum to provide fixed broadband service to the home.
Okay, great. And we have about 7 minutes left, so I wanted to touch on two last topics. The one being CapEx. So shifting gears to your overall wireless spend, particularly on the macro towers, the story has gone that AT&T more or less completed its nationwide LTE coverage, and as a result, your wireless spend has been at lower levels for roughly the last 18 months. However, if you've taken a breather and gotten through your initial investment period with DirecTV in Mexico, that wireless spending could pick back up again. Kind of decipher, I think that's the investment community's perception. Kind of break that out for us a little bit so we can have a better appreciation of what's really perhaps happening there.
Well, you know, the wireless network enhancement never stops, right? I mean, we talked about enhanced mobile broadband and low latency services. Of course, we haven't even talked about autonomous cars, and if there are many of these cars and they need to communicate with the infrastructure in sub-millisecond type of time frames, the wireless network needs to continue to evolve. So I'd say that our spend will shift based on what is our demand, certainly moving to small cells, introducing new spectrum, bringing in some of the latest in antenna technologies, doing a lot of carrier aggregation, using more sophisticated modulation techniques like 256 QAM. So these are all tools that we will deploy just to continue to enhance our wireless network.
And, you know, one of the things that's also being talked about in terms of where CapEx dollars may be shifting and also just in terms of small cells is the C-RAN architecture. Can you tell us what C-RAN is and how important you think that's going to play in the future?
Yeah, so if you look at a small cell as a mini version of the macro, then essentially the small cell acts very much like a macro, except it's at 70 feet or below. compared to a macro, which could be as high as 200 feet up in the air. It blasts much less power, and it handles a smaller number of customers. Now, this architecture has some limitations because you have lots of small cells, and we go from one small cell to another, you can have handoff issues, so you could have interference issues with the macro. So one part is to just do the radio at the small cell, but not do the baseband, and bring all the baseband back to a central location using what are called front haul links from the radio back to a central location. That's the Cloud RAN architecture. Now you can make collective decisions for all the small cells at one time, so you minimize the interference and you optimize the handoff as people move around in the small cells. Pros and cons, you have much more transport to worry about, so the transport costs go up. On the other hand, you have a much better radio resource management layer, which actually may improve performance. I think both architectures will play out. It'll be case by case. And as we get better at transport costs and better at radio resource management, you'll certainly see more Cloud RANs show up in the network.
It's really interesting because one of the things you and I have talked about is that it effectively enables the network to be much more dynamic so that it knows how to shift demand from one cell site potentially to another, and also it's going to become intelligent enough so that it knows if you're using a specific type of application that you actually should be using a specific type of spectrum band. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so typically if you're just texting and you're in your house, you could use the macro LTE network or doing small scale browsing, let's say 4 or 5 megabits per second or something. On the other hand, if you're doing massive browsing and you need great throughputs and you're not moving, you could use your Wi-Fi node. But if you're on the move, you want to maintain your session, you really want to use the small cell with the millimeter wave radio. And all of this needs to happen at millisecond time cycles, just because you don't want to lose your application. You want to keep the application intact as you move. Now, that sort of radio resource control is best done in a centralized manner and best done with software control. And when we take SDN into the RAN world, you will obviously see benefits of that show up in these kind of implementations.
And is this what we're part of 5G, or can we do this with 4G LTE Advanced?
There's only so much you can do with 4G LTE Advanced because the RAN is not disaggregated, so I have limited control, software control over the RAN. But when I disaggregate the RAN, then I can do extensive software control. That's what I need to really make millisecond decisions based on application.
We have 2 minutes left, and I wanted to talk about one last topic, and that's the DirecTV OTT offerings, which you guys have announced you're going to launch in the fourth quarter. I think it's really interesting because, to me, it represents the first potential OTT solution that could be cannibalistic to cable, and I say that because it's linear. It's a channel lineup, effectively, opposed to an on-demand offering, which is what Netflix is today, and therefore is more complementary. It seems like if this is as big as what it could potentially be in terms of being effectively a DTV solution, just OTT, that it's going to require a lot on the network, both from a wireless perspective, but then also perhaps on the wireline side. Is the network in position today to support that?
Yeah, current assessment is that it is. We have 40 megahertz of spectrum in AWS-3 and WCS that's largely not deployed yet, that we could deploy largely nationwide. We also have a much aggressive fiber strategy, as I explained, as part of the 12.5 million connected location commitment. That allows us to take fiber to cell sites, allows us to take fiber to buildings as well as homes. So as an integrated carrier, our current assessment is that depending on the take rate, if this take rate is wild and creates a stress on the network from a capacity and throughput standpoint, we definitely have the tools to upgrade the network. But for now, our assessment is that network will handle the extra stress.
So a potential opportunity to use AWS-3, which you have not yet deployed, as well as the WCS spectrum,
right,
really as a dedicated channel, if you will, for this to the extent that it's needed.
That's correct. And we can also use some of the latest software, antenna and modulation techniques I talked about earlier to get much better spectral efficiency on those bands.
Great. Well, with that, we have 9 seconds left, so I think we're going to conclude. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
Thanks
it.
A lot for having me here.